From the studios of KPCW, welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our impacts upon it. I'm Claire Wiley, and today we're going to be taking you from Africa to the Arctic. First, we're going to be speaking with Jackson Lucea, Solash Marumpi, and Tim LePage from Safari Experts about the new Rapoi Nature Conservancy in Maasai Mara. That's in Kenya. The conservancy was created to expand the protected land for wildlife. They're going to be discussing some of the issues facing the Maasai Mara wildlife and their habitats and what this conservancy means to the survival of these animals, the surrounding communities, and generations to come. And then Chris and I go back into the Arctic with National Geographic explorer Greg Okori Crow, who comes on to talk about beluga whales, elusive narwhals, and a new study regarding a unique species of seals. Okori Crow works with the Wildlife Evolution and Behavior, or WEB, at the Florida Atlantic University. That's all coming up. It's This Green Earth. Stay with us. And welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley, and we have a full house in our studio today. Joining me is Solash Marumpi, and we also have Jackson Lucea, and they are owners of Mara Siana and founders of Mara Rapoi Conservancy. And we also have Tim LePage with Safari Experts, and Tim is also a local here in Park City. Thank you so much for being a part of This Green Earth today. We appreciate you. Why don't we start with you, Jackson? Tell us a little bit about where you're from, your background, and your relationship now to the Maasai Mara.
I've been a guide for many, many years. And I think I've been guiding for about 35 years and lived in the Maasai Mara all of my life and stayed there with my family, my children who are living there, my wife, and I'm a conservationist as well as a founder of a lot of conservancies within the Maasai Mara. When the conservation effort was started, basically I was right there at the very beginning. And I remember the first time to ever receive funds that have come from conservation. It was probably 1985 or 1984. And these founders who came and they said, now we have money that could be charged off from tourism and it can trickle to the community. And I had about $350, which is about $3. And I was so excited to have $3. That was a lot of money. And the whole community behind were grateful about this. Is amazing that wildlife can turn out to be like our cows. And that's how we relate everything. We relate all the wildlife to be our property. And that's the birth of conservation in my life. So from then I started the guiding very early on. I think I started guiding in 1988. That was the first time I've ever gone into guiding safaris and being trained by also another local. You know, you have to learn from somebody else. And there was a white guy, Kenyan, called Ron Beaton, and I keep relating my life to him. And he introduced everything to me. He gave me my first wildlife book, and he gave me my first bird book and my first butterfly book, and I started learning about the flowers and everything. Yes, it's the flowers and the butterflies and the animals that I live with, but I don't know the English names. And so from there, when he has finished translating that, then I started now being a teacher myself, translating that to the people who have come to visit. Not only that, translating now to the people who are behind me, you know, the young guides and upcoming guides, both male and female. And that is how I started, and that's where I am right now.
And Solash, tell us a little bit about your background as well.
Well, a little bit similar to Jackson's, but I don't want to copy and paste. We were brought up in the same neighborhood, and Jackson went a slightly different way, and I went a slightly different way, and about 25 years ago, we came back together. And truth be told, and you give Caesar to what belongs to Caesar, being a guide and being who I am right now, he's played a big role in it, because when we came back together, I was already a guide and I wasn't, and I was like, I'm gonna be a guide. And he held my hand, like everybody needs a hand along the way. And he's been very instrumental in my journey to where we are at the moment. We come from the same village. We've shared a lot in common. And we've been very truthful and honest to our journey, because we are at the moment in my community where we've been brought up very traditionally, but whatever that we're doing has just made a transition in our life and cultures that we're sharing. I mean, right now we're here, we're dealing with things and people from a different part of the world. And then when we get back to the village, you go back to where your roots are, and they think totally differently. And we are right there in the middle, being the people that connect both cultures and breaking that barrier and making sure that there is a rapport. And we got into guiding as a career, but all along the way, we decided that we only are not guides. We also be very instrumental and integral in conservation. We're not just going to do the business, we're also going to do something that will last longer and that will be a lasting memory and transformative to anybody who goes to visit that place and anybody who lives there.
And so you have founded the Maropoe Conservancy. How far and vast is it, and why did you think it was important to do that?
It is very important because, one thing that we all accept is that spaces for wildlife and natural beauty is constantly shrinking by the day. It's not in America, it's not in Maasai land, it's not in them everywhere. There's this constant pressure from human habitation and growth. Population is growing. So we have to be proactive and being trailblazers in conservation in that area, we had to go a little extra mile. And so Jackson and I bumped into this beautiful place that had all the potential, had all the wildlife, beautiful landscape, beautiful flora and fauna, and we decided that we are going to use this place for the benefit of the people living at the moment and generations to come. And that's why we decided to take that slightly longer road, which is a bit of doing, because it takes endless meetings with the community to try and get the concept going for everybody to understand that what we're doing here is for the benefit of you economically and biodiversity perpetuation. And had a lot of meeting together and decided that if we do this, it will impact very positively on the people around here.
So describe, for people that may not know exactly where Maasai Mara is, describe where that area is, a little bit about the environment there, and then, like I said, how vast is the conservancy and what can be found there?
Yeah, I would say if you're familiar to Africa, you know, pin to East Africa, Kenya in particular, and go west, all the way to the west before you hit to Lake Victoria, that's where Maasai Mara, at the north tip of the Serengeti in Tanzania. That's where we are located. You've got wildebeest, zebras, giraffe, elephants, lion, leopards, and rhinoceros. You know, every single species that you can think of when you go on safari is found there. And so the conservancy, when it started to be formed, our community sat together, along together, and say, we need to set aside some land just for conservation. Some clever people are out there, some visionary, I would say, rather than clever, visionary people who think probably 50 to 100 years to come. And they set aside 6.5 acres per person in about 2,500 members. And let's just imagine how much land is there. When you put 6 acres, 6 acres, you say, this is a conservancy, cannot live here, cannot develop, it would only be wildlife forever. And so when we discovered this piece of land and we came across, it was chaos, as you would expect. Poaching was going on, snares was going on. Every Tom, Dick and Harry was there to do whatever they can to take it for granted. And we said, let's give it a try. Let's give it a chance. So I and Salash, we joined hand with Fred, which is our other business partner. We said, oh, it's going to be hard. The thing is, we like hard things. When you make easy decisions, it's not going to last. If you make hard decisions, you know it's going to be very difficult to get to the bottom. We did it. And Mararipoi has got hills, it's got open plains. What do you dream when you go to Africa? You need to see this beautiful golden open savanna plains. You've got acacia riparian forest, beautiful yellow fever trees that you will go and you can do bird life there. The walking there is just magical. And then you have this other countryside that is forest, and it's not very big forest. It's like shrubby forest that is favorable for giraffes and many other ungulates such as impalas and kudu. We had kudus there. We had rhinoceroses there. And wild dogs go through there and elephants. Fantastic, fantastic ground for everything. And it has become, right now, is a corridor between the Greater Maasai Mara Game Reserve to our eastern part of one of only forests that is sacred left called the Luita Forest, named in Enkio. And so the wildlife go through that. And because we have conserved now, a lot of wildlife are staying longer, particularly the elephants. But territorial animals like lions, hyenas, jackals, butted foxes, these animals are there forever and they stay in their families. And us being there, our presence, have given them a future and a life. We see babies. It's like a breeding ground. It's just giving us so much pleasure.
Mm. So, Tim, I know that you have a special place in your heart for Kenya. Talk to us about that. And then also, you have taken people with safari experts over for many, many years. And what are the things that you're seeing when you first started taking people on safari to now? So take me through first your background and then your experience of how the landscape has changed.
I'm born and brought up in Kenya. We actually brothers from another mother. So to go home, which I go home every year for at least 2.5 months, I keep my airplane there. And I've been taking people from here, from Park City, since the early 90s. And in fact, Jackson's very first guiding trip was with John Ulch from Park City. And back in, I think, 1991, maybe 92. So what I see when I go back and I get in my plane and I fly out over the Maro ecosystem, I am shocked because everywhere there are new settlements of people and fences. Fences, of course, to protect the individual people with their farms and their own livestock, but to keep the wildlife out. And this is links completely back into what Jackson and Salash have begun to do in Ripoi. And as he said, it is an extension of the Mara ecosystem. So it is adding another 20,000 acres, and there's more to come. And every acre is the chance for wildlife to survive for the next generations, because we cannot look at our grandchildren and say, we did our best, unless we did something. And that's why I'm so proud to have them here in Park City. Everybody should do this. This is not about going on safari. This is about going to participate in today's modern conservation world and contribute to it and make a difference. And take your children, take your grandchildren.
So there are some real challenges that are happening throughout that area, population growth, that human wildlife conflict that is happening. There is sometimes the overuse of fishing and loss of some of these animals because their habitat is shrinking and those resources start to shrink as a result. So what is your greatest hope for this conservancy then? Do you feel like it will bring back some of what we have lost, or are we at this point of maintaining so we don't lose more?
Well, I think, and in my opinion, I think we've gone through a lot of challenges, and we still have a lot of challenges ahead of us. You have to protect that land from further encroachment. You have to protect with the rangers. You go to train those rangers who risk their lives. They're out there. Some of them don't even have shoes to patrol. Some of them don't even have uniform to be identified as rangers. And they risk their lives from the wild animals to those rogue poachers who would go over there and kill these animals for their benefits. And so the challenges are plenty. And the resources are very, very scarce, to protect this land and to get these resources to go to the channel to the right place. And the other challenge is you have now a community around this who have donated or given this land for wildlife. And there is a lot of high expectations from them. And those expectations are, how can we participate to educate the future, the generations to come? With or without resources, they will see wildlife as an important thing for the nation, an important thing for their children and children's children. And so that is the next challenge. But the biggest challenge currently is, how do we protect that? How do we preserve that? How do we get enough resources to get the challenges of poaching going away, the snaring? You know, a poacher doesn't care. You know, he goes there and put a snare under a tree, and they're not segregative. They can take an impala, he can take a lion, he can take an elephant. You still see lions with three legs, and you see elephants with half a trunk as a direct result of those snares that are being used by poachers. So the challenges are absolutely a lot, and we need to continue to increase. Our target for Marari Point right now is, we have 20,000 and we'd like to add another 15,000. But that would be convincing the community and the people who own certain parcel of land that's not used to say, right, can we bring this on board to be part of the conservancy? But now, how do you fund that? How do you get enough money to pay those people on quarterly basis or yearly basis for the next 35 years, for the next 50 years, until the next generation catch up with us and said, hey, daddy, hey, father, this, we can take along this.
And so it seems counterintuitive, but the way in which to conserve these areas is to bring people there. A lot of what we talk about here on This Green Earth is, if you are a part of it, if you experience it, if you see it for yourself, then it brings you to this point of care. And when you care about something, you act upon it. So when people go there on safari, in exchange, not only is it boosting economy for the villages, but do you see then people more caring and more apt to take action to help conservation?
Yeah, I think what we try and encourage and we try and define it is responsible tourism and travel, because by so doing, the trickle effect is unbelievable. And as Jackson has said, there's a lot of challenges. And the biggest challenge is to make sure that what we've secured, what we've got around us here, let's try and secure it, and let's keep the trajectory in the direction it's going. And to do it, we need resources. And there are a lot of many ways of trying to look for those resources. A is by people traveling responsibly to that part of the world, because by involving themselves and introducing them to that magic makes them basically spread the word, bring more resources, and everybody around there will slowly spread out and dissolve into the community around there, and all the conservation efforts that we're putting in place, because the salaries, the fuels of the rangers, and the salaries of the people working in it, and as we started saying in the beginning, we committed to the community that with or without, we shall pay you something every quarterly. those are the biggest challenges that are there. But if we get it, if we get people traveling, coming to stay with us and enjoying that magical place, then those challenges get easier and become a little bit easy for us to tackle.
So I have traveled there before, and I can attest to the fact that it touches you in a way that you can't really explain. And there is that interconnectivity of, even if we live across oceans, we should still care about what's happening to our planet.
We can be millions of miles apart, but if we have a common belief that this is the right cause and this is what we can do to make humanity and the world that we're living in a better place, then nowhere is far. It's all close.
And so what do you see as the hope for the future in that area? What do you hope for?
The hope for the future is that I see in that area is to continuously protect as much as possible. There is so much protection that is needed in a conservancy. You know, you go look at the diversity of different species of animals and different species of grass, different species of insect, different species of plants. I mean, and the land management, so that there is no further degradation when you are starting it. You know, there is so much that is there. It's so dense, and it's impossible to describe. It's like when you get there, you know, your brain is buzzing from all the beauty and the happiness that brings to you. And particularly when it comes to nature, I protect the ticks, the ants, the termites, the birds, the eagles, the big wildlife, and the list goes on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And the reason is, there isn't anything God has given us without a reason. There is a particular role every single species is playing when it comes to nature. And one of the things that I like to add is, we're human, and as a species, we are so close and loving to each other. And you don't know until you step into that land. You arrive and all of a sudden your brain and your mind and your spirituality wakes up. And that's a joy that brings to me as a guide, as well as an owner of this particular small venture of a business. It is to see other children of God, other people come and meet us, and we go together. And we have this language that we speak that we don't know where it comes from. It's the angels' language, I would say.
I love that. And we talk here a lot about ecosystems and how each, tiny as it may be, part of our planet relies on the other part. And that if we're all working together and we're all protecting these species, then these ecosystems will stay healthy. And the health of the ecosystems is what, in the end of the day, we all are relying on, whether it be plant, animal, or human. And I really appreciate you coming in here and talking about your conservancy, talking about its importance. And Tim, you also take people over there, have been doing for 40 years, it sounds like, and showing them these ecosystems and these different ways of life. What is your favorite feedback from them?
Remember that Kenya is the cradle of mankind. 3.2 million-year-old hominid fossils are found in the north of the country. People come away with a certain spirituality from Kenya. And my most common feedback and comment is, thank you for doing this special trip because it changed our lives. Richard Leakey once said to me, he said, there is an innate connection with some people, sensitive people. You have to be able to feel that, but he made that comment. But the bottom line is that it is, particularly today, your experiences in places that are making a difference in these remote places. It's so dramatically different. Even living in this area where you have some wildlife and some open space, it is so different in pace, in emotion, in sensitivity, that it does. It changes your life forever.
there are fewer and fewer of places like this that are remaining. And as I said, if we want the generations to come to experience what we're experiencing at the moment, let's start by making these small moves individually.
Well, I have loved my time here with all of you in the studio. We have Salash Marampi, who is one of the owners of Marasiana, Jackson Losea, who is also an owner at Marasiana, and they have both founded together Mara Ripoy Conservancy, and of course, Tim LePage of Safari Experts. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thanks
Thank
for
you.
Your time.
From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Chernia.
And I'm Claire Wiley, and we're going to be speaking with marine biologist and National Geographic explorer Greg Okori-Crow, who joins us to talk about Arctic-based marine life, specifically beluga whales, elusive narwhals, and a new study regarding a unique species of freshwater seals. Greg, thanks so much for being on our show today.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, first off, just give us a little bit of a 411 on the Wildlife Evolution and Behavior Program, or as you call it, WEB, at the Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute.
Yes, thank you. So our team focuses on primarily marine mammals, both in some tropical and temperate zones here in Florida. But a lot of our work is also being done in the Arctic and the North Pacific. So we go to some very remote locations and we get to study some incredible animals like beluga whales and narwhals and seals. And we do a lot of that work in partnership with indigenous communities right across the Arctic. So that's kind of the overview of the kind of work we do.
And getting into those studies, there are only, as I understand it, 5 seal populations worldwide that live year-round in freshwater habitats. And one of them is a kind of enigmatic population of freshwater seals that are found in Alaska's Iliamna.
So, yeah, Iliamna. So you're right. Freshwater seals are a very rare thing. They're supposed to be in the ocean. But there are a few populations. There's 5 worldwide, and 4 of them are really well known and quite well studied, from the Baikal seal in Siberia to a number of ring seal populations in Europe. But there's one in Alaska that's probably the most enigmatic, as you say, the least studied and the most intriguing. And Iliamna Lake is the largest lake in Alaska. It's actually the 7th largest lake in the United States. It's even bigger than the Great Salt Lake. Hmm. It is home to, you know, the Dena'ina, Aleutic, and Yupik people who have been the guardians of the lake and the guardians of the seal from time immemorial. But they have been studied relatively little compared to many of those other populations.
So what were your main reasons when you set out to study them, and what were your findings or conclusions?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it was honestly just an intriguing kind of, it almost seemed an anomaly that there was this these reports of a population of seals that lived in a lake a long way from the sea. And I thought a long time ago that someday I'm going to get to study those, hopefully. But there's also important management issues relating to, you know, small populations of any animal. And so there was some issues that, you know, we felt should be addressed and that we could do that. And our initial studies relied a lot on indigenous hunters very generously providing skin samples, critical skin samples, and that we could do the genetics on. And that reveals that they were harbor seals, and they were not what we thought might have been the case, which were spotted seals. And they sort of gave some interesting preliminary hints that they might be quite different from populations downstream in Bristol Bay in the Pacific. But several years passed, and then a young graduate student, Donna Hauser, and her advisor, Tom Quinn, from the University of Washington, were studying the seals and salmon in the lake and collected a lot of scat samples to do that. And then we were able to turn that into a genetic study where we could extract or try to extract and screen DNA from the seal scat. And my colleague and research coordinator, Tatiana Ferrer, spent countless hours in the lab screaming at her sequencer, trying to get the data, and managed to pull off an amazing stunt and collect enough data from the scat that finally allowed us compare the population in the lake to populations elsewhere. And what we found was that they were not only really different from seals downstream in Bristol Bay, but they were really, really different from seals elsewhere across the Pacific. So that was like a really surprising and striking finding. So yeah, that's kind of what we're trying to kick on from there now and do more genomic work to find out more about these remarkable seals.
So it's maybe more of what is happening internally or with how they operate than really their social behaviors that is different.
So what we've really established with this new paper is that there isn't a lot of movement or gene flow between this lake and other populations. And looking at that and indigenous knowledge and early written reports by Russian explorers in the region, it's looking like these seals have been there a long time. Now, how long is the next question we're trying to understand? But they have certainly made Iliamna their home, and they've been there a long time. And so you would think that there's probably some local adaptations that have occurred over the years, and that's something we're intrigued to sort of discover hopefully next with the genomic analysis. And then we want to help the indigenous communities and the management agencies involved to help conserve and protect these animals and their future.
Yeah, and with the finding of these freshwater seals in this one particular lake, perhaps the possibility of other lakes on a global basis, I'm thinking of Russia, Siberia or so, that also might hold freshwater seals.
True. I mean, there's still a lot to discover out there. You know, we're talking about some very remote locations. And I think what's really interesting is that we can compare now all the different freshwater seals. Like I said, some are subspecies of ring seal, which is a completely different species,
yeah,
and try and understand how seals adapt to a freshwater environment, how they manage to succeed and thrive in a very unusual habitat. And that's, you know, I think something now collectively a lot of scientists are going to try and study. And I can tell you a lot of my colleagues who've worked on seals elsewhere, you know, they likewise didn't know about these seals in Iliamna. So certainly getting quite a bit of attention.
Right. And another great example that we come upon on this show is like the more scientists look, the more we find out, the less we know in many cases.
Oh, it's a very humbling experience. But it excites you and it drives you on. I mean, when I look at some of the traditional knowledge from the people in the region, you know, very often what I find, no matter where I work in the Arctic or subarctic, is when I relate to them some scientific information, they usually say, yeah, we know that.
Oh.
And it keeps you humble and it keeps you honest, you know?
Yeah, they kind of look at you with a shrug. Like,
yeah, and say, we already knew that.
Why is this paper new? About it.
Yeah, but also, you know, this is my quick aside, this drives me nuts when I read about the tens or hundreds of billions of dollars that are being spent to explore Mars when we haven't even finished exploring this planet. But I can't help but opinionate on that.
I couldn't agree more. And I would say to your listeners, you know, that's what's so exciting. There really is a frontier still out there to be explored, to be discovered, but also to be protected and, you know, conserved. And always try and partner with the people of the land, because they know more than you'll ever learn. And I have really found that has been been a wonderful surprise in my research that you know, I thought I was so focused on the animals and the environment, but the gift of having to work with you know, the people of the land has been just probably the most satisfying. I think I would speak for my entire group, and that's what we really treasure. Mm.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think we would also like to go further into the Arctic and talk about another elusive creature that you studied, the narwhal, which has been lovingly described, I guess, as the unicorn of the sea. And I know a lot of people at this time of year, the image that I guess we conjure up is that famous cameo in the movie Elf. And that might be the only way that people really know about what a narwhal actually looks like, but I'm curious to break down where they're most populated, what their diets are, some of their social behaviors. Why don't we start with where they reside?
Well, you're right. The elf cameo actually has been very helpful to spreading the word about these really mythical creatures in many ways. You know, for centuries, explorers and hunters brought back the narwhal tusk, and you know, that was in many ways the origin of the unicorn story. And they are an almost impossible animal. I mean, when you're literally in the water with them, you still can't get used to the fact that these magnificent animals and the amazing tusks that they grow. But they mainly occur in the high Arctic. We don't have them in the Pacific Arctic. They're mainly in the Atlantic Arctic. They are known for being very deep divers, and they can dive to incredible depths to feed, and they live among the ice. But fortunately for scientists like me, they sometimes come close to shore in the summers. And we've been studying narwhals in the Canadian High Arctic with our Canadian colleagues, and also with Indigenous people of Nunavut, in a fjord or in a bay in the high Arctic for the last three summers. And literally every day we find something that we didn't know. And you really feel you're on the edge in every way.
What's the purpose of the tusk?
Well, funny you mentioned that. You know, it's probably the most iconic, but also enigmatic feature nearly in nature. Everybody knows about the tusk, but there's still, would you believe, a lot of debate as to what it is in fact used for. And it's almost certain that it's some kind of what we call secondary sexual characteristic. It's used by males to compete for access to females, either by trying to impress them or to try and fend off competitors. Mm. But we're starting to realize that they might have other uses for the tusk. And that's where things get really intriguing. A paper came out many years ago saying that, you know, they're highly innervated and they're very sensitive to environmental conditions. And so they may be able to detect changes in salinity and temperature. But the problem with that explanation, of course, is only males have it. So what, females can't do this? What we're starting to realize is narwhals may use their tusks to help them hunt for fish. And so that's just one of the things we're trying to understand. But we're also focused on, both with narwhals and belugas, is looking at how they're adapting to a changing Arctic. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that probably has to do with behavior, social behavior, things like social learning, you know, cultural transmission. So that's what we're trying to do with National Geographic at the moment.
We are speaking with marine biologist and National Geographic explorer Greg Okorie-Crowe, who is joining us to talk about Arctic-based marine life. And we've been talking about the narwhal here, and you had kind of mentioned a little bit about their diet and a warming world. What's happening in that realm?
Well, yeah, that is a concern, right? So, you know, are narwhals going to be able to adapt to, you know, a decline in ice, shifting prey? And I think a big part of that ability to adapt to change, it's the same with humans as it is with any species, is you change your behavior. That's probably the first thing you do. You change what you eat, you move to different locations, you sort of find a way. And so we're kind of right there. It's like a giant experiment in a way, maybe not the one any of us would have chosen to design, to see how narwhal are adapting to those bigger changing conditions. But on top of the issues with regard to maybe a changing environment is the increase in human activities in the north, specifically shipping. So an increase in sound pollution and things like that. And the indigenous communities are very concerned about that, as indeed are our Canadian research colleagues.
Are they commercially hunted at all?
No. In the past, they were, and certainly belugas were. They are a subsistence resource for a number of communities throughout in Nunavut in Canada. They, like the indigenous people of Iliamna, are in many ways the guardians of these amazing animals, and they provide both cultural and dietary sort of needs to a lot of those communities. So they're not commercially hunted.
Well, let's turn our attention to beluga whales. You do quite a bit of research in that area. What is their state of health and welfare with respect to human interference and climate change, et cetera?
So it's kind of more of a mixed story with beluga whales. There are some populations, thankfully, that are very healthy, and they tend to be the ones in the high Arctic. But there are a number of smaller populations in sort of subarctic regions, for example, like Cook Inlet in Alaska and the St. Lawrence Seaway in Canada, and that's a number of others where their numbers are very small. And part of that has probably been due to past commercial hunting and or harvesting. But the concern is that some of them are not recovering despite decades of really good protection. And so there's a concern that when you get so small, can you recover? Mm. And again...
We lost you for a second.
Big diversity and sort of the capability of populations to recover. But we're also trying to look at behavior and again, see how social behavior in particular, and what's really interesting about social behavior, and if you think of human populations, you have these two sort of competing factors when you look at how social behavior can help a population. You have cultures that emerge, not just in humans, but in other populations, for example, like elephants, and we've shown it occurs in beluga whales, where, you know, you inherit traditions as to how you do certain things. And so with belugas, it's where you go and when you go. And those have served belugas just as they have served humans and elephants and other species really well over the years. But sometimes you need someone to innovate a new idea, right? And so you have the kind of traditionalists and then you have the pioneers. And pioneering is kind of a much more risky strategy, but it's certainly needed when something changes. And we have this issue in our own societies where we can become hidebound by tradition and culture. And we need people who can innovate and take a risk and take a chance, and maybe that'll get us out of the jam that we're in. And I believe this is probably what's happening in some of these really sophisticated cetacean species. And belugas are creatures of habit. But because they're social, if somebody comes up with a new idea, well, it could go viral, right? It could spread very quickly because we mainly learn from others. We don't all try and figure out the world on our own through trial and error, right? That's really inefficient. So this is what I'm hoping to understand with narwhals and belugas is social learning and how new ideas in a changing world can kind of get them out of jail.
Beluga caviar. I mean, are countries still harvesting belugas for, among other things, their caviar?
Thank you for bringing that up. So the caviar comes from a fish called the beluga.
Ah.
And it's a giant sturgeon, and the beluga is the Russian for white, and so it's a white sturgeon. And we use the term beluga because the Russians, you know, they call belugas beluga. But there are countless names for beluga. But yeah, that's a pretty well established misconception. Yeah. So thank you for bringing it up.
Oh, well,
that would be some big caviar.
As embarrassed as I am, I thought I know everything until I come on this show. Thank you.
Yes.
Live birth. Got it, Chris. Okay. Last few minutes. Let's go back to Florida. Where you're at, you're in Fort Pierce. And I spent years living in West Palm and Jupiter, so I know the Indian River Lagoon and Indian River ecosystems, et cetera. You've done work on bottlenose dolphins in the Indian River Lagoon. Talk about some of the challenges they face, human and otherwise.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, there's this very interesting population of dolphins in this long, narrow lagoon on the Atlantic coast of Florida that we've shown genetically and using satellite telemetry are highly resident to this waterway. And the reasons for that become abundant. As you know, when you go there, it's a highly productive, highly diverse lagoon and estuarine system, one of the most diverse, in fact, in the entire continent. But unlike some of the lagoons I've studied in the Arctic, it's home to millions of people, and there are a lot of nutrient inputs that have been continuing for decades into this relatively shallow, narrow system. And we're dealing, sadly, with the consequences of all that nutrient input and also rising temperatures globally. And we are now experiencing quite a lot of habitat loss, harmful algal blooms, and Harbor Branch is kind of on the forefront of studying those bigger issues and their impacts on fish and the entire communities in this lagoon. And colleagues here at Harbor Branch are studying the upper trophic levels and the top predators, the dolphins. And what we're finding is they are indeed dealing and having issues. And occasionally we have these, what they call unusual mortality events, and that gets a lot of press. Mm-hmm. And those are very concerning. But I also feel the important point with a lot of these animals is dolphins are tough. And belugas are tough and seals are tough. And if you just take your foot off the gas, they will rebound. It's like they have what it takes. The problem with us is we never take our foot off the gas. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I try and say to people, all is not lost. You know, animals are resilient and systems are resilient. But if you keep bashing it, you know, there can be these tipping points where it just won't recover. And so there's a lot of genuine interest and concern, not just for the dolphins, but the entire system.
Yeah.
And we're really gratified that the public have kind of taken this to heart and they want to see more work done. And they support a lot of our work through a license plate program and the Harbor Branch Oceanographic Foundation, Institute Foundation, has supported a lot of our research. And that's people putting their hands in their pockets and buying a specialty license plate.
Well, and we only have a minute or so left, but I have to add that when you speak about, I like that term, we don't take our foot off the gas, because the challenges the Indian River Lagoon faces, among other things, is the annual release of nutrient-rich water out of Lake Okeechobee. It goes down the St. Lucie Canal into the lagoon, Indian River Lagoon. Then you say, you know, huge algal blooms as a result. Anoxic conditions. It's a ripple effect in many ways that begins in a cattle ranch somewhere in Central Florida.
Well, you know, I mean, yeah, it shows we're all connected. And again, your local fisherman and your local stakeholder is going to say, duh, of course this is what happens. So it's kind of a collective problem, and therefore it's got to be a collective solution. We can't be pointing fingers at people. We just have to say, you know, you're right, there are these cause and effect issues. We all need to work together and, you know, try and solve it. And I just think capitalizing on the concern is what we need to do right now, both in, you know, the houses of power, in schools, educating people, and then, you know, in the lab, which is what we're trying to do.
And Greg, if people want to learn more about wildlife evolution and behavior, where would they go? Do you have a website?
We do have a website, yes. You can find us on our website, web.wix. And you can also go to Florida Atlantic University's website and find us there. And yeah, there's a number of social media outlets as well. And I just want to thank my team, Tatiana, Laura, Jorge, and many others who really do, they do the hard work, and they deserve a lot of credit.
Dr. Gregory O'Curry-Crowe, marine biologist, National Geographic explorer, thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth. This Blue Earth for you.
Yes, and thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right.
Thank you.